So, again, in Genesis 3:15, we did see that the Messiah, the seed of the woman, would be a human, and that the Messiah would defeat Satan. He would crush the head of the serpent and reverse what Satan accomplished at the fall. That is, the murderer of the human race. But in doing so, his heel would be bruised, which was fulfilled on the cross. Now, when we move into Genesis 4:1, which is not actually a messianic prophecy per se, but it does give us some insight, because it does reveal to us Eve's perspective, an important perspective that Eve had on this seed of hers who would be the Redeemer. And again, I'm going to read Genesis 4:1. And I'm going to read it first from the NASB, but then I'm going to read it from the NIV, because the NIV does a better job. Now the man had relations with his wife Eve, and she conceived and gave birth to Cain. And she said, and this is the key passage, I have gotten a man-child with the help of the Lord. Now in your Bibles, where it says with the help of the Lord or through the Lord or something like that, those words should be italicized, because they're not in the original Hebrew. They're put there by the translators to, in their effort to make it more understandable. And we went through a number of translations and saw how different translations dealt with them. The NASB, the NIV, and actually, I made a mistake. The NIV also says, with the help of the Lord, I have brought forth a man. That's not the one I was thinking about. That also has the idea of her just bringing forth a man with the help of the Lord. But in the Jerusalem Targum, it says, I've gotten a man, the angel of Jehovah. So it doesn't say anything about with the help of the Lord. What she's saying is, I've gotten a man, the angel of Jehovah. And we took some time to look at Genesis 16 and Exodus 3 to demonstrate that the angel of Jehovah, the angel of the Lord, is the second person of the Trinity, the Son of God. And so the point is, what Eve was saying was, I have gotten a man, the Lord. She believed two things. She was theologically correct, but her timing was off. She believed that this seed, this human being, would also be God. And that's theologically correct. She was right. That's the incarnation. But her timing was off. She thought that right away it would happen with her firstborn Cain. We know that a lot of time passed before that prophecy in Genesis 3:15 was fulfilled. But we can see even from early on in Genesis, the incarnation, which is denied by, for example, modern-day Judaism, is affirmed in various places in the Old Testament. For example, Job, who was a contemporary of Abraham, said in his book, I know that my Redeemer lives, and in the latter day he will take his stand upon the earth. Now that implies that the Redeemer will have an earthly body. God is spirit, so that can only be accomplished through incarnation, by God taking on human flesh. And then we looked at one other perspective, and that was the perspective of Lamech. And Lamech, who was the father of Noah, in Genesis 5 said, he called his name, his son's name, this is Lamech speaking, Noah, saying, this one shall give us rest from the work, from our work and from the toil of our hands arising from the ground which the Lord has cursed. So Noah also believed in the coming of the Messiah, and he was, again, right theologically. When Messiah is completed his redemptive ministry, the curse will be removed and toil will be removed. However, again, his timing was off. He believed that Noah would be the Messiah, his son. And as we know today, that was not to be. A length of time was to pass, a good length of time was to pass before Messiah would come on the scene. Now, we're going to begin with some new material, and we want to start in our notes on page 116. We won't need our Bibles for a little bit, but start on page 116. Now, before we go into this, we're going to be discussing something that goes back to Genesis 3:15. One of the things I didn't mention about Genesis 3:15 yet is that it says in Genesis 3:15, I will put enmity between your seed and her seed. So not only is there going to be a crushing of the head of the serpent and also a bruising or a striking of the heel of the Messiah, but there would be this continual enmity between the two of them, essentially between God and Satan, but specifically between the second person of the Trinity who becomes incarnate and Satan. And one of the things that Satan throughout history attempts to do or has attempted to do was prevent the Messiah from even appearing. For example, that's one of the reasons that Satan has historically tried to destroy the Jewish people, because he knew that, I mean, he knows the prophecies. He knew that the Messiah would come from the Jewish people, so he tried to destroy him. But there's another strategy that Satan used, and we're going to be discussing in Genesis 6 right now an interesting passage. Now, this particular passage is not, again, a messianic prophecy per se, but it has to do with the coming of the Messiah and with Satan's attempt to prevent that from happening. Now, we have what we call a messianic line. We know that the messianic line begins with Eve, obviously, Adam and Eve. We haven't developed that much. Actually, we haven't developed it further yet. But Satan wants to corrupt the line of the seed. He wants to corrupt the human race so that it is no longer capable of producing a God-man. And we'll see how he does this. First, read Genesis 6 with me, starting from verse 1. And then we're going to discuss it. Now it came about when men began to multiply on the face of the land, and daughters are born to them, that the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. Now, one of the things we're going to have to do, and do very carefully, is determine who are the sons of God who are being spoken of here, and who are the daughters of men. Because that's open up to different interpretations. Then the Lord said, my spirit shall not strive with man forever, because he is also flesh. Nevertheless, his days shall be 120 years. And that was prophetic of the flood, which came 120 years later. But now verse 4 comes along. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came in to the daughters of men and bore children to them. So whoever these sons of God were, and whoever these daughters of men were, their children were the Nephilim. And it says they were mighty men who were of old, men of renown. Now the important thing is this. When we read the flood story, this insertion here about the Nephilim really appears to have nothing to do with the flood story itself. It seems to be like a little aside. But there are no asides in the Bible. When we look at this, we're going to see this has a lot to do with the flood. But then it goes on to say in verse 5, then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was evil continually. The Lord was sorry that he made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. The Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, from man to animals to creeping things and to birds of the sky, for I'm sorry that I have made them. So we can see here one of the reasons that God brought upon the earth the flood was because the wickedness of man had gotten so bad that essentially he had to start over with Noah. He didn't eradicate the human race, but he had to start over with Noah. But we still have this question of the Nephilim, of the sons of God and the daughters of men. What do they have to do with all this? Because they're right there in the context, and we're going to find out now. Now go to your notes, page 116, and Roman numeral 1. Maybe you could sit in such a way to, well, you can listen to me, or you could move your seat and share with somebody, but I'm going to be reading pretty clearly, I hope. We have seen that Eve, to whom the promise of the seed was given, believed that the Messiah would not only be human, but would also be God, the incarnation. We have also seen that a contemporary of Eve, Lamech, believed that the Messiah would remove the curse on creation that resulted from the fall. Both are right. Their timing was, their theology was correct, but their timing was off. It will also be instructive to see how Satan, who instigated the fall, responded to the promise of the coming of Messiah in Genesis 3:15. What was Satan's response to this? He had, in his eyes, victoriously, you know, caused man to fall. Now God promises that the curse of the fall will be reversed and that God will one day become a man and defeat Satan. And so how does Satan respond to this? Now go to Roman numeral 2. Satan is God's enemy. And when we say Satan is attacking us, he's attacking us. We're kind of like pawns. The real enemy of Satan is God. Now, he does hate us, and he does want to kill us and so forth, but he attacks us because we're God's creation. And notice what it says. Satan is God's enemy. As God's enemy, he desires to thwart the redemptive plan of God. He doesn't want redemption to take place. He instigated the fall, and he wants things to stay that way. He murdered humanity in the garden with a lie. He surely shall not die. And ever since, he has been trying to prevent God from overcoming man's death through the seed of the woman, the Messiah. His first attempt is recorded in the scripture we just read in Genesis chapter 6. And again, there's no unnecessary details in here. So let's continue and read on, and hopefully what we're going to do is we're going to find out who are the sons of God, who are the daughters of men, who are the Nephilim, and what does this have to do with God's plan of redemption, okay? 3, Genesis 6, 1-4 gives us a description of the state of affairs of Adam's descendants. Many believe that these verses are an introduction to the story of the flood. The wickedness of man was great on the earth, and it's kind of an introductory portion of Scripture that leads to the flood, and are descriptive of the wickedness of mankind and the horrific deeds that caused the flood, or that caused God to bring about the flood. This view has resulted in a number of interpretations of 6:1-4, focusing, it shouldn't say too focused there, it should say focusing on the wickedness depicted in them. Now, what we're focusing on right now for our purposes is Genesis 6, 1-4, and specifically in Genesis 6, 1-4, the sons of God who went into the daughter of men, had sexual relationships with the daughters of men, and their offspring was the Nephilim. And that's, we want to determine just who are all these creatures and what do they have to do with God's plan of redemption and Satan's reaction to it. Everybody follow so far what our objective is? Okay, continue with me. Our interpretation of Genesis 6, 1 to 4 will be determined by our interpretation of who the sons of God in verse 2 and then the Nephilim in verse 4 are. There are two main views as to who the sons of God are. Okay, let's look at the first one, A. And this is the one that I ascribe to. The sons of God are angels. I believe that the sons of God in this passage are angels. Now, let's continue to read. This is the oldest view. For example, the Codex Alexandrinus, a 5th century manuscript of the Greek Bible, refers to the sons of God as angeloi, which is angels. So that's an ancient view. In the Tanakh, the term the sons of God, B'nei HaElohim, commonly refers to angels. And we have some examples there, Job 1:6, 2:1, and 38:7. So it is not inconsistent. In fact, it is consistent to refer to the sons of God in the Old Testament as angels. Now,
are you saying that in the Alexandrian code they use the word angels as opposed to sons of God?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. Okay, number three. Possible support in the Brit Chadashah for the sons of God being angels may be seen in 1 Peter 3:19 and 20 and 2 Peter 2:4 and 6. And 2 Peter 2:4 and 6 is the significant one that I want to read with you. So you can either turn to it or just listen. But in 2 Peter 2, listen what it says. For if God did not spare angels when they sinned, and I believe that this is talking about, well, let's read. But cast them into hell and committed them to pits of darkness reserved to judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a preacher of righteousness with seven others when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly. And so there you see again, the question is, when did the sons of God sin? What is Peter referring to? And the context seems to indicate he's talking about something within the context of the flood. Because look what he says again. Look how he attaches these two statements together. God did not spare angels when they sinned. And then in verse 5, and did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a preacher of righteousness. So there's a good case for Peter referring to the angels sinning prior to the flood, and that in fact the sons of God in Genesis 6 are angels. Yes. Well, let's continue. That gets us a little bit ahead. We're going to get there. But I want to take this one little step at a time. In fact, the very next thing we're going to read is going to address what you're questioning. Okay, but let's read number three again. Possible support in the Brit Chadashah, that's the New Testament, for the sons of God being angels may be seen in 1 Peter 3:19 and 20, in 2 Peter 2, 4, and 6, where the fallen angels, the flood, and the doom of Sodom form a series that could be based on Genesis, and in Jude 6, where the angels' offense is that they left their proper habitation. That's very important. The angels left their proper habitation in Jude 6. Now, what we're going to see, and we're going to continue on with this, when Jude said the angels left their proper habitation, I take that to mean that angels are not to procreate with women, but they left their proper habitation and did so. Now, read number four with me. This will explain one of the possible problems we could face. Now we're talking now about the view that the sons of God in Genesis 6 are angels, and that the angels procreated with the women of men, and their offspring within the Nephilim. That's where we are so far. Now, read number 4 with me, because there's something we have to deal with. This view appears to contradict Matthew 22:30. For in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like the angels in heaven. So the view that the sons of God in Genesis 6, and the view that those angels of God had sexual relationships and procreated and had offspring with women, human women, seems to contradict Jesus' statement in Matthew 22:30, where he says that we will be like the angels, will no longer marry and be given in marriage, which obviously means we'll no longer have children. However, continue to read with me. However, the angels in heaven are righteous angels, whereas the angels on earth are fallen angels. There may well be a number of significant differences between the righteous angels in heaven and the fallen angels on earth. Whereas the righteous angels in heaven do not procreate, the fallen angels on earth may well be able to mate with a woman and produce offspring, just as men and women on earth do. Now, the important thing here is God does not waste words. And notice that God did not merely say, well, Jesus did not merely say, they will be like the angels, no longer marrying nor giving in marriage. He said the angels in heaven. He limited it to the angels in heaven. And that's an important, just that little phrase there, the angels in heaven, differentiates between the angels in heaven and the angels on earth. That's why that phrase is put in there. So, continuing on, here's another viewpoint. That's a more modern viewpoint. The sons of God are royalty. I'm sorry, this is also an ancient view. It is found in the Targum Angelos, the oldest Aramaic translation of the Tanakh, where B'nei HaElohim is translated sons of Lord. So that's another viewpoint. And then one more viewpoint, C, the sons of God are the godly line of Seth, and the daughters of men were from the ungodly line of Cain. The problem with that is, what some people say is that by the godly line of Seth, having relationships and having offspring with the ungodly line of Cain would therefore pollute or corrupt the messianic line. But the problem there is that when God brought the flood, only Noah was left and his family. So the godly line of Seth and the ungodly line of Cain would not have really had an effect on that. But read with me. 1. According to this interpretation, these intermarriages corrupted the godly line, and the flood brought this corruption to an end. That's what this says. In favor of this interpretation is the fact that many warnings against marriage between believers and unbelievers are given in the Tanakh. See, I do want to present all the different varying views on this so we can get a feel for which one we're most comfortable with. 2. However, this interpretation does not deal adequately with the fact that the sons of God commonly refers to angels in the Tanakh, not to human beings, and that the term daughters of men has no specific or technical connotation. In other words, as it's used in the Old Testament, B'nei HaElohim, the sons of God, refers to angels. And that's very clear in the opening passages of the book of Job. However, so there's a technical use of the term the sons of God to refer to angels. But when Moses wrote the daughters of men, That has no technical usage. The daughters of men are simply female human beings. Okay? D. To translate Genesis 6:2 literally, and that's what we're aiming to do here, the literal method of translation, would be to make the passage say that angels selected human women and married them. In light of the fact that an accurate rendering of the words of Genesis 6:2, let me read that better. In light of the facts and an accurate rendering of the words of Genesis 6:2, we may conclude that the sons of God were angels. And this is the interpretation that we will use here. It's merely a matter of linguistics and literary interpretation. When God uses the term Ben HaElohim in Genesis 6, that same term is used elsewhere in the Old Testament. And whenever it's used, it only refers to angels. It's never used to refer to a genealogy of human beings. And it's significant that daughters of men has no technical usage. They're simply the daughters of men. So it appears as though what happened here was fallen angels procreated, had children with human women. That's what they did. Now, why did they do that? Let's continue to read. There's a reason that they did that. Number 5 on top of page 118. This intermarriage between the fallen angels and human women was an attempt by Satan to corrupt the seed of the woman. The offspring of these marriages were then the Phelim, that's literally translated giants. These creatures were mighty men of old, men of renown. So you see, what Satan was attempting to do here was have fallen angels mate with human women, produce Nephilim, and these Nephilim would multiply, and ultimately the human race would no longer be a purely human race. It would be a hybrid of humanity and fallen angels. And that would totally corrupt the Messianic line, because the Messiah could no longer come and be fully human in the incarnation. Now, read number 6 with me. The account of the flood immediately follows Genesis 6:1-4. The flood destroyed the Nephilim and thwarted Satan's attempt to corrupt the seed of the woman. Now, we can skip down to 6a. We've already read the passage, 6:5-7. As the above passage describes, human depravity was widespread, constant, and habitual. Man was fully corrupt. His heart was evil, and his conduct was wicked. This made man sorrowful. He was grieved in his heart. B, in order to deal with the tragic devastation sin had produced, and with the pain it had caused him, God destroyed man from the face of the earth with a flood. So you see, there's a dual reason for the flood. One is mankind had become so utterly corrupt that God realized he had to wipe humanity off the face of the earth. But Noah, who was the one righteous man in the world, found grace in the eyes of the Lord, and God started over with Noah. That's one purpose of the flood. It's a cleansing. The other purpose was to thwart Satan's attempt to corrupt the seed of the woman by having fallen angels mate with human women and produce a hybrid of angelic and human beings, and that would totally corrupt the line of the seed of the woman. As they multiplied, and that was Satan's idea. He wanted to corrupt mankind and make mankind no longer fully human, but half fallen angel and kind of half human, and then the line of the seed of the woman would have been corrupted. Messiah would not be able to become incarnate and fully human, which was necessary for redemption. Now, read B with me. In order to deal with the tragic devastation sin had produced... Wait, I read that. Well, let me... No, I didn't read. Did I read that? Yeah, okay, 7. Thus, we may conclude that the flood served two purposes. One, to avoid the corruption of the seed of the woman attempted by Satan. And two, to judge the wickedness of depravity to which man had fallen. So there were actually two purposes for the flood. Yes. Well, many theologians believe that the seed of Satan ultimately is the Antichrist. And that's the final battle. Ultimately, that's the climax of the battle between man and God, is between Messiah and the Antichrist.
And it wouldn't be connected with the connected.
Excuse me? No, the seed of the the offspring of Satan, I've never come across a theologian, nor do I see reason to consider the Nephilim the seed of Satan. Now, I just went over, and Bob and I consulted with some good references. The Nephilim, the etymology of the word, in other words, how was the word developed and what does it really mean, is a little bit obscure. However, the reason it's often translated giants is because that's how they translated it in the... I'm giving you the short version now. That's how it was translated in the Septuagint. That's how they saw it. However, it appears that it may very well come from a root, nephal, which means fallen ones, which would have some meaning to the context we were just studying. Okay? But that Hebrew word Nephilim is a bit obscure. But there's good reason. If it does in fact come from the root Nephal, which means fallen ones, that would very well fit with Genesis 6. Okay, let's move on. Now, go to page 119. Oh, I have some announcements to make. The book of Acts in church history is going to start April 7th. So anybody who's interested in taking, it's going to be taught by John O'Dell. Anybody who's interested in taking the book of Acts or the book of Acts / church history, there are these little brochures that describe the course are back there. April 7th.
Day or night?
Only night. Also, the Passover Seder dinner is full, but you can get on the waiting list. There's going to be another one Bob's going to do, though, at Shoreline Church on Friday, April 2nd. And if you're interested in that one, you contact Kiara. One more thing. We will not have class on April 1st, which is next Thursday, because of Passover.
Sure, that's not a joke.
What's not a joke?
We don't meet on April 1st.
No, it's not. Okay, let's continue on. Go to page 119 in your books. Has everybody got their name now on the sheet with an X under today? Good. Page 119, we're going to continue along there. Now, I know that that passage we dealt with in Genesis 6 is not the easiest to plow your way through. That's why I tried to take it a little bit slowly. But now we want to continue on, and we're going to continue on with this concept of the seed of the woman. Seed means, literally, in our language, offspring or descendant, really. And on page 119... we're going to be dealing with Genesis 22, 15 to 18. Okay? But you don't have to look in your Bibles because I got it right here on the page. So, as we have seen, according to Genesis 3, 15, the Messiah was to be a seed or a descendant of the woman. That is, he was to be a human being. Very important. Of course, this information does not narrow down the possibilities very much. However, as we read through the Tanakh, the Old Testament, we find that we can trace the line of the seed and discover key aspects of Messiah's genealogy. And that's what we're going to be doing for the next few prophecies. We're going to be working on his lineage, because it's given in the Bible. And it's interesting the way it's given. After Genesis 3:15, the next mention of the seed is found in the Abrahamic covenant. This is the covenant that God made with Abraham. Now, look in your notes or your Bibles, if you don't have notes, or just listen. Genesis 22, starting from verse 15. Then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, "By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and not withheld your son, your only son, indeed I will greatly bless you and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens." Now there the word seed is being used. Seed is a singular, but it can be singular as in like Israel is made up of many people. So it can be like what you might call a compound singular, or there's a plurality. It's kind of like saying a single bunch of grapes. That's one way it can be used, and that's how it's used the first time there. When he says, "I will greatly multiply your descendants as the stars of heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your seed," notice it's going to be plural here, "shall possess the gates of your enemies." But then it goes on to say, "And in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because you have obeyed my voice." And that's a reference to the seed of the woman who is the Messiah. In your seed, in your descendant, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. And that prophecy about the nations being blessed is followed up in Isaiah, where the Lord says to the Messiah, to the Son, "It is too small a thing that you should bring back to me just the house of Israel. I will make you a light to the nations." So that is expanded upon. But what we can see here is we're narrowing it down a little bit, because now we know not only does the Messiah, the seed, have to be a human, the seed now must be a descendant of Abraham. It narrows it down. And that's what Messianic prophecy is all about. It's a progressive revelation. It's a progressive narrowing down of the possibilities until in the end it can only be one man, Jesus. Okay, 3. The Abrahamic covenant is extremely important, for it is foundational to God's plan of redemption. A covenant is similar to our modern day contract. The two words mean just about the same thing. It's just that covenant was an older use of the word. Generally, each party to the covenant binds himself to certain conditions and is promised certain advantages by the other party. So if I enter into a covenant with you or a contract, I'm obligated to do certain things for you. You're obligated to do certain things for me. So you derive certain benefits and I derive certain benefits. That's what a contract is all about. And that's also the same as a covenant. However, read number 1 with me. An exception to this general rule is a unilateral contract in which only one party is bound to certain obligations. The other party is to receive certain advantages, but the fulfillment of the covenant is dependent solely on the faithfulness of the obligated party. So that's a different. Now, we don't have that in our law today. If I promise you something and obligate myself to do something for you, but you're not obligated to do anything for me, in our system of law, that's not a contract and it's not enforceable in court. But this is ancient culture and history in which it was a valid covenant. Everybody follow so far? Okay. 2, a covenant in which each party has obligations may be called a bilateral covenant, like bicycle, two-wheeler. A covenant in which only one party has an obligation may be called a unilateral covenant. That's like unicycle, one obligated. As we shall see in our study, the Abrahamic covenant is unilateral. Its fulfillment depends solely on the faithfulness of God. In other words, when God made the covenant that he made with Abraham, and that covenant contains a number of promises, the obligation to see that that covenant is fulfilled depends only on God's faithfulness, not at all on Abraham's obedience. Yes? Well, the thing is, when the covenant is first mentioned, it's clearly unilateral. That wording, because you have done this thing, is commendable to Abraham, and he's recognizing Abraham. In a sense, what he's basically saying is, you've taken the faith that you have as described by Romans and demonstrated it as described by James. But it was faith that justified Abraham. And just to take a few moments to demonstrate the fact that it was a unilateral contract, a covenant. Do you remember when God had Abraham go get the animals and cut them in half and make the trench? That's how they ratified a covenant in those days. How do we do it in our days? We sign it, right? When we have a contract today, both parties to the contract sign it. If there aren't the two signatures there, it's not a contract. Legally enforceable. The way they used to do it in Abraham's day, they didn't sign a piece of paper. They dug a trench, took small animals, cut them in half, and put on each side of the trench. And the blood of the animals went into the trench. And the two parties to the contract each stated their obligations and walked through that bloody trench together. And they each said, may God do so and more to me if I do not fulfill my obligations. In other words, may God do what was done to these animals if I don't fulfill my obligations. So when God ratified or entered into this covenant with Abraham, what did he do to Abraham first? He put him to sleep. In fact, the Hebrew there is the same sleep that he put Adam in. It was a very deep sleep. And then God manifested himself in a burning lantern and a torch. And only the lantern and the torch went through the trench, indicating it's a unilateral contract. Furthermore, if we compare the Mosaic covenant with the Abrahamic covenant, in the Mosaic covenant, when it was ratified, God said, if you, so forth and so forth and so forth, then I will. So that's what it says in the Abrahamic covenant. It's conditional. That's another word that can be used for a bilateral covenant. It's conditional. He said, if you obey my laws and statutes, then I will make you my people from among all the peoples of the earth. But when we read the first mention of the Abrahamic covenant in Genesis 3:1, a number of times God says, I will, I will, I will, I will, I will. Never once does he say, if you. It's unilateral. Okay? Okay. Top of page 120. The fact that the Abrahamic covenant is mentioned numerous times in Genesis and is referred to in the Brit Chadashah highlights its importance. It's first mentioned in Genesis chapter 12, and then from 12 through 50, chapter 50, it's mentioned an average of every three chapters. It's very important. Now, see, if we study all of the passages in Genesis that concern the Abrahamic covenant, we find in them many promises that God made to Abraham. However, there are three major provisions. These are the three major provisions of the Abrahamic covenant. One, the land. Genesis 17:7-8. And I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants. So notice that Abraham's descendants inherit these promises. After you, throughout their generations, for an everlasting covenant. Notice there's no conditions being set. And by the way, the last passage you read, what did it say? The Lord said, by myself do I swear. He swore by himself. Okay. And it says, and I will give to you and your descendants after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. That's the land provision of the Abrahamic covenant. Okay? It becomes a separate covenant in the Mosaic law. That's how important it is. It's called the land covenant. Notice that the covenant was to be passed on to Abraham's heirs. Now, the second important provision of the Abrahamic covenant, number two, is blessing. Genesis 12:2, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. So blessing is an important aspect of the Abrahamic covenant. In fact, again, it becomes a covenant of its own in Jeremiah 31, the blessing covenant, which we sometimes refer to as the new covenant. Behold, the days are coming, the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. And then he goes on to describe the blessings he will pour down upon them. And finally, the seed portion of the covenant. And in your seed, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because you have obeyed my voice. Okay? Now, as I said, number four on the top page 121, these provisions of the Abrahamic covenant are so important that each becomes not merely a provision of the Abrahamic covenant, but a separate covenant in its own right. And first, we have the land covenant in Deuteronomy 31-5. Now, we're not going to take the time to read all of that, but read that when you have time. And the important part of it is towards the end when he says, if your outcasts are at the ends of the earth, from there the Lord your God will gather you, and from there he will bring you back, and the Lord your God will bring you into the land which your fathers possessed, and you shall possess it. That's the land covenant God entered into with Israel because they inherited it from Abraham. Then the blessing covenant, which, as I said, is often referred to the new covenant, is in Jeremiah 31:31-34. And we're not going to, again, read this whole thing because I have the whole covenant here, but listen what this says here towards the middle. But this is the covenant which I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. And here's the blessings. I will put my law within them, and on their heart will I write it, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And they shall not teach again each man his neighbor and each man his brother, saying, know the Lord, for they shall all know me from the least of the greatest of them, declares the Lord, for I shall forgive their sin, and their iniquity I shall remember no more. So that's the blessing covenant. Then there is the seed covenant, which grows out of the seed provision of the Abrahamic covenant. It's often referred to as the Davidic covenant. And if on the top of page 122, we see 2 Samuel 7:12-16. And the important thing for us to read here, again, we're not going to read the whole thing, but at the very end, look what he says to David. And your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever. Your throne shall be established forever. And that's speaking of David's descendant, King Messiah. That's the seed covenant, which derives from the Abrahamic covenant. Now, this particular covenant is very important, and we're going to look at it again because it appears twice in scriptures. So notice what it says. This covenant is significant to our study and will be discussed as we proceed. We're going to go into great detail about the Davidic covenant. It's very important. Okay, five. There are a number of things that are significant about the Abrahamic covenant and the three covenants that are based on it. A, all four covenants and every aspect of each covenant will have a literal and not an allegorical fulfillment. Those aspects of the covenant that were to have been fulfilled historically have been literally. Now, if you go to Genesis 12, 2 and 3, for example, one of the things in the Abrahamic covenant that has already been fulfilled is, I will make your name great. Remember he said that to Abraham? Abraham, well, the three great religions of the world, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, all claim Abraham as their forefather. That was fulfilled literally. So to take the Abrahamic covenant or any of the covenants derived from it allegorically and not literally is inconsistent with the way they've been fulfilled up to this point. Also, God promised Abraham in the Abrahamic covenant, I will multiply your seed and make a great nation of them. That happened, didn't it? So it's a literal fulfillment, not an allegorical fulfillment. And then it goes on to say, as we shall see, the seed provision of the Abrahamic covenant has been literally fulfilled in Messiah. The second thing, all four of these covenants, Abraham, Davidic, blessing, and land, are eternal. They all, just go up to the top part of the page where 2 Samuel is. Notice what it says, your throne shall be established forever. And God said to Abraham, I will give this land to you, your descendants, forever. They're all eternal covenants that have no end. C, all four covenants are unconditional. Their fulfillment depends solely on the faithfulness of God and not at all on the meritorious behavior on part of Abraham or his descendants. And that Genesis 15, 7 to 21, that's the passage that contains what I was describing before with the ratification in the trench. Abraham did not walk through. He did not take part in the ratification. He was under no obligation. Okay, now, here's a very important passage. The covenants cannot be revoked. Romans 11, 28 and 29. The context is Israel. And listen what it says in Romans 11, 28 and 29. 9, 10, and 11, Paul is discussing Israel. And in Romans 11, and this is the verse that replacement theologians have absolutely no answer for. Those who say that the promises given to the Jewish people through Abraham have been taken away from them. Listen to what it says. Romans chapter 11 and verses 28 and 29. From the standpoint of the gospel, they, the Jewish people, are enemies for the Gentile's sake. In other words, the Jews rejected Messiah. What happened? The gospel went to the Gentiles, right? So their being enemies of the gospel was for the benefit of the Gentiles. It benefited them. But from the standpoint of God's choice, they are beloved for the sake of the fathers. Who are the fathers? Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, to whom the promises were made. For the gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable. Replacement theologians who believe that the promises made to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and then Israel have been revoked, they have no answer for that verse. It's the weak link in their argument. It was one of the weak links. 5, for now we are concerned with the seed provision of the Abrahamic covenant. Genesis 22:18, and in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because you have obeyed my voice. As we have seen, the Hebrew word translated seed, which is zerah, means offspring or descendants. 1, zerah is always singular. This is what I was talking about before, but may refer to an absolute singular, that is one person, or a collective singular, that's one group. Like when we say the United States, we're talking about a group of people. Okay? When used collectively in the Abrahamic covenant, zerah refers to the nation of Israel. When used as an absolute singular in the Abrahamic covenant, zerah refers to the Messiah. We have seen in Genesis 3:15 that Messiah would be a seed or descendant of the woman. He will be a human being. Now, the Abrahamic covenant narrows down the possibilities. The Messiah will be a seed of Abraham. That is, the Messiah will be a descendant of Abraham. The genealogy of Messiah, which is now beginning to take shape, will proceed further, will develop further as we proceed. In other words, what we're going to be working on right now and probably for the rest of the next session will be the genealogy of the Messiah, which was extremely important. Now, let me just leave you with one word. The Messiah had to fulfill every prophecy, right? Therefore, he had to fulfill the prophecy concerning his, all the prophecies concerning his genealogy, right? Abraham, and I'll give it away, Isaac, Jacob, Judah, Jesse, David. He had to come through that line. And we're going to look at every one of those prophecies. We've only looked at one so far. There was no problem with finding out whether or not he fulfilled that. All you had to do is go to the temple and look in the Hall of Records at the genealogies. Every Jewish person's genealogy was there way back to Adam. They kept amazing records. However, you'll notice two things. Number one, nowhere do any of the Pharisees accuse him of not being a descendant of David. They couldn't, because all he'd have to say is, let's go over to the Hall of Records and take a look. Number two, the temple and with it the records have been destroyed, so no one can prove themselves to be a descendant of David any longer. In other words, the Messiah has to have come before AD 70, the destruction of the temple. Because since then, there's no way the Messiah, anyone can prove, anyone can establish their genealogy. Yes?
I read that it was Herod, prior to the destruction of the temple, to burn the genealogical records to so various deaths could not be followed up.
I haven't heard that. It might be true, but I believe that it was when the Romans destroyed, because the Romans were the ones who destroyed the temple. They destroyed the city and the temple. So, okay. Questions, comments? Anybody need another cookie? Yes.
Yes. Can angels be men or women?
Can angels be women?
Yeah.
Well, are you asking me, can they literally be women or can they appear to be women?
Because the sons of God, you said, were fallen.
We'd have to speculate. I don't know. The Bible doesn't speak to that issue.
Yeah.
So we know that they can appear as men. Whether they can appear as women or not would be speculative. Yes?
So the land of Israel should belong to...
And ultimately will. The Jewish people. If somebody ever says to you, who does the land of Israel belong to? The answer is God, who has given it to the Jewish people. They will. That's one of the prophecies in the Bible. It's happening in our day. It's being fulfilled in our very day. Yes, you had a question?
No, that's not a question. Do you remember someone who was talking
about this? Wait, a little louder. I can't hear you.
There was a movie made some years back with Meg Ryan. She fell in love with an angel. This angel came down to earth and the angel was like, an angel. She falls in love with him.
Oh, of course, he would have to become a human if they wanted to. I didn't see the movie, but I remember the previews. Yes.
So, as America goes more and more against Israel,
we do it to our detriment. Believers?
Yes, and pro-Israel.
Pray for our leaders.
Should we plan to get out of America?
No, we should just plan to be where God wants us to be.
Okay.
That's up to Him.
That's right.
Yeah, plan to get raptured.